know, I just fell down. I blacked out, fell down. And when I woke up, it's a pool of blood on the floor. Pretty sure my nose is broken, but.
All of that occurred away from the action, and Gene Katie just a little upset with what's happened so far.
Robinson around Ostertag.
Down again is Jawan Johnson, 3 for 3 from the field.
You're listening to the Purdue Basketball Beat, a part of the Boiled Sports Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to the Purdue Basketball Beat. I'm Michael with Andy and Anish. Hey guys.
How's it going?
Hey.
And we have a very special guest with us today, Brian Newbert of Golden Black Illustrated. Hi Brian, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks guys for having me. Appreciate it.
We're very excited to have you, mostly because with you on the radio, I think we've got a decent chance of breaking into the double digits as far as listeners is concerned. So, fingers crossed, I hope this goes well.
I'll do my best.
So, so we've got Brian on today just to talk a little bit about Purdue basketball, mostly. And so I'll start off. So how long have you been at GBI?
Since 1999 in some capacity or another. You know, I went to Purdue. I worked at the Exponent throughout my college years. I began at Golden Black as an intern back then and got a full-time gig thereafter, right after graduation. That was in 99. So I've been at Golden Black. How many years is that now? 15-ish years, somewhere around there. A decade and a half, amazingly. I now feel 90.
Yes. One of the interesting things about, so given that 15-year time span, how have you sort of seen your job evolve over that period of time, mostly with recruiting? You know, in that 15 years, we've seen, you know, Facebook and Twitter and just the internet in general really become more ubiquitous. Has that really affected how you do your job?
Well, it's not the same job. It's an entirely different job than it was when I started. You know, when I started, it was a magazine, and I worked solely for the magazine. And today, all of our efforts go into electronic online products, with the exception of Golden Black Illustrated's 4 glossy magazines a year, or 6 glossy magazines a year. Other than that, all of our efforts go into our Golden Black Express print publication and goldenblack.com, obviously, which is something we've obviously had to move so much of our efforts into over the course of time. In terms of from an editorial standpoint, things are unbelievably different because we deal in a 24-hour news cycle, obviously. I obviously cover a very small portion of the sports world, but everywhere now it's the 24-hour news cycle. Everything's online, so there are no deadlines anymore. Your deadline is ASAP, always, which is a good thing and a bad thing sometimes because sometimes you don't have to hurry quite as much because, you know, it's 1 o'clock in the morning, no one's reading anyway. But at the same time, you're working at 1 o'clock in the morning. Otherwise, you know, social media has changed everything because you produce the information, you got to get people to see it. Now, it's almost like half your job is marketing, instead of actually gathering the information because there's so many different ways you can get that information out there and so many aggregators out there waiting to take the information, put it on their websites that you have to set yourself apart, even though your job is being on the front line of getting that information, kind of putting out that analysis, I guess the right word would be. So it's changed everything, absolutely everything. Like I said before, it's not the same job. It's not the same job at all. Covering recruiting especially is very different because teenagers now have become their own press agents, for better and worse. We're forced to follow lots of teenagers on Twitter and Facebook and social media because they're going to make their announcements to the world themselves, thus kind of cutting us out in a sense that back in the day we used to be the only the only medium for those kids to put information out there about their recruitment. The other issue is there's 10,000 of me out there now. We've always been trying to be as respectful and professional about covering recruiting as possible. I can't say the same for the hundreds and hundreds of people like me out there who think it's cool to cover recruiting, don't play by any rules because traditional media rules have kind of gone out the window over the years because the definition of media in itself is entirely different today than it would have been back when I started. This makes me feel so old, by the way. I don't know what to say here, but the point is that my job is entirely different.
Well, so you said a lot of things there that were super interesting to me, in terms of the way that media has evolved and the responsibilities that you see. But first, I'm most curious about what your job was like in, like, let's say 2000. Like, what was the typical day on the job when Drew Brees was on campus?
I'm not kidding when I tell you I don't remember. Back when I started, we put out one magazine a week. We didn't have any online responsibilities because there was no online. Mm-hmm. And I'll be damned if I can remember what I did in the summer. I really have no idea what I did in the summer.
Days?
Now, July is my busiest month of the year. No. June's not far behind. I have no idea what I did in 2000. I remember all the football games, but I don't remember anything else about that year. In terms of what I did on a day-to-day basis at work.
So does the timeliness of information given Twitter and social media, all that, does that change how you vet which information you feel is worth putting out there to your subscribers as opposed to what it was like in the early 2000s? Do you feel like you need to put more information out there?
Absolutely. Social media has changed the game entirely from a media perspective because everybody wants to be the first one to tweet something. And that is so unbelievably stupid that it's affected all of us. But we have to play the game because that's what's expected of us. If you don't tweet something 4 seconds before somebody else, somebody's going to notice and somebody's going to show up in your chat session on Wednesday and troll you. And from a credibility standpoint, people expect the people they rely on for information most to have things in a timely manner, which is translated to mean they want you to have it first. And you know what that does? That makes us wrong. I'm proud to say that we haven't been wrong more than a few times in my time here on stuff, and almost every time we have a damn good reason why we were wrong about something. You know, sometimes you're right at the time and then things change on you. Mm-hmm. But I'm trying to think of what I was saying here. The race to get things on Twitter faster than everybody else has just, it's created such stress on people that they just throw out whatever they get. And I think you've seen a couple of very intensely covered stories at Purdue alone here the last couple of years. When you look at Matt Painter in Missouri, when you look at Caleb Swanigan and his recruitment after he decommitted from Michigan State, how much bad information there was out there was astonishing. Because everybody wants to get something out there, even if it hasn't been properly vetted. And there's so many people out there now talking to so many people covering this stuff that you never know what's true. You just have to trust the people you trust and, you know, hope things don't blow up in your face. But the race to get stuff out there before everybody else is unbelievably damaging to the entire media industry, if you ask me.
So I've noticed several times, as a subscriber, I'll see something that you'll post on the board that looks to be like to get ahead of something like that. Is that like you're given all this information and the fact that way over half of it is erroneous, is that the value add that you see a media outlet like GBI providing in that vetting of that information of if you hear it from this source, you know that it's true?
Yeah, I mean, it's important for us. If we're not ready to put something out there as fact, it's important for us sometimes, simply from a saving face perspective, to just go to our people first and say, look, this is something we're hearing. Now, I always try to delineate between this is what I'm hearing and this is what is true. There's way too many people out there throwing stuff out there about here's what I'm hearing, this is true. Mm-hmm. But I always try to get out in front of that stuff, and our staff does the same, and just to tell people, look, there might be something brewing here. Just kind of keep your eyes and ears open. We will let you know as soon as we know something definitive. But it is a great challenge. Now, the other part of your question before is what social media has, you know, changed for us, in the sense that obviously we run a subscription website, and we've had an unbelievable response over the years to our website, and an unbelievably loyal following, which we appreciate profoundly. But it is a very difficult line to walk, because social media, by very definition, is, you know, free information. And we try to set ourselves apart as much as possible with the kind of background and perspective and analysis we think we're able to provide, because we've got 50 years or whatever it is of experience covering Purdue and whatnot, and people on Twitter can barely spell. But I say that with love. You guys, I'm obviously not talking about you guys.
He's talking to me. He's talking about me. It's okay. He's talking about me.
I know how hard it is to spell on Twitter. I've had my share of typos, because Twitter, by nature, hurries you up. That's another pitfall of Twitter. It's just a pretty big challenge for us to make sure we are differentiating ourselves from free social media and whatnot. I think we do a great job adding value to things. I just hope people know that. And that's kind of my commercial here for GoldenBlock.com.
So we
are a subscription site. So is the newspaper nowadays. The newspapers are asking to subscribe as well. There's a lot of great bloggers out there. A lot of great bloggers. A lot of people doing a lot of good work, including, I think, your guys' site. There's a lot of idiots too, though. You have to have a filter, and you know, unless you have a really discerning, critical eye, it's very hard to delineate one from the other. So,
you can feel free to name anybody you would like.
Yeah, I'm not going to do that.
So Brian, let me ask you this one question. So the changes in, like, kind of, I guess, the way that your job has evolved puts you in such a different position in terms of the feedback that you get and the response from people, and I think also the passions has grown too as we get this new information. How has that affected you personally? Because I know that when I write something in to a small audience, I get a lot of pushback, or, you know, any mistake or misinformation, people love to, you know, point that out. I mean, how does that impact you, knowing that you know, no matter, basically you're almost in a lose-lose situation, that no matter what you say, there's going to be people who argue or want to, you know, want to troll you?
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. I mean, I don't want to paint a picture that I'm just under this incredible, you know, scrutiny all the time or anything like that, but there is pressure, and that's what this new environment has kind of created. This thing doesn't leave my hand typically, which is, you know, unfortunate sometimes. But that's kind of the environment we exist in nowadays. But, you know, at the end of the day, I get paid to watch football and basketball, so I have no complaints whatsoever.
Are you still a fan?
I am a fan of New York Yankees.
So when approximately did your Purdue fandom kind of take a back seat to everything? I mean, like, so I assume, from reading you, I can tell that it's very much an unbiased, and you can be unbiased, you can write unbiasedly as a fan too, but I can tell that you take your job much more as a neutral journalist than a fan writing unbiasedly, if that makes sense. When do you think that kind of escaped you, or did you even have that big fandom in you to begin with?
Yeah, no, there was no transition whatsoever. I was, when I got to college, I set out to be a journalist, and I conducted myself as a journalist from day one. Never really allowed any sort of emotion to come into play. Now, the one thing I will say about media objectivity is there's not a person on this planet who would rather deal with unpleasant people than pleasant people. So when people say that the people who cover stuff have no stake whatsoever in their teams being successful, I would rather deal with pleasant people. We'll put it that way. But I'm a fan of New York Yankees and New York Jets. Otherwise, I am just a man walking the earth like Kane in Kung Fu.
So we've talked a little bit about how social media and this sort of new media age impacts your interaction with subscribers or other people who are interested in the thing that you write about, but how does that impact how you get information from or just interact with recruits or the circles that tend to surround recruits, since recruiting is such a big part of what you do?
Yeah, I mean, I think any journalist is critical to establish relationships with people and maintain those relationships. And when you've been doing something for 15 years, you've established a lot of relationships. So a lot of time I spend is, stroking is a bad word, but maintaining relationships with people who can help you at some point in time. And a lot of those people are there for you when you need them, and that is very much appreciated. You know, you are only as good as a reporter, as a journalist, as the people who help you. And I think every young reporter needs to understand that. Every young reporter needs to know that you are, again, you are only as good as the people who are helping you do your job. And that has very much been the case for me. You know, it's so important to establish strong relationships and mutually beneficial relationships too, if that makes any sense.
So from a mutually beneficial standpoint, is that what you're providing back, like exposure for athletes, just general networking? What's that relationship look like when you're talking about high school coaches or AAU coaches or parents or recruits?
Well, now more than ever, I think it's just whatever is mutually beneficial. Getting the story out accurately, I think, is something everybody should have at the top of their minds nowadays. When it comes to recruiting, that's one thing that doesn't happen very often. I think it's very important to a lot of people for their stories to be told accurately and professionally and with the majority of the words spelled correctly. But I think sometimes there are information sharing sorts of situations where people want to know what you're hearing too. You want to know what they know. Mm-hmm. And if you can establish that sort of give and take, that can be very, very beneficial as well.
One thing that strikes me is it seems like when Purdue is successful, especially in basketball, and we touched on this a little bit earlier, a lot of self-styled recruiting experts tend to pop up, and they pop up not just on Twitter or on message boards talking about what they know, but you know, I've heard stories about people showing up at high schools, contacting athletic departments at high school, like really trying to be a journalist but doing a really poor job of it. Does that affect you, or is that just more of an annoyance? Or have you witnessed that?
And a lot of people like me spend a lot of time debunking bad information to the point where sometimes you feel like you're responding to other people's information more than you're out gathering your own. And that's the product of Twitter. That's the product of kind of what I said before, in the sense that everybody out there is a journalist now. The person who might be out at the bars one night and overhear somebody saying something about somebody who might be at the other side of the bar, all of a sudden that gets on the message boards, that gets on Twitter, that gets on Facebook, wherever. Somebody picks it up. They come to you to find out about it. You tell them it's not true, and then 6 months later it turns out maybe there was a shred of truth to it. Then you look like an idiot because they think you were covering up for somebody, or you're just out to lunch on something. So there's a lot of pressure involved in that. But like I said, at the end of the day, I get paid to watch football and basketball. So just mentioning this stuff to kind of illustrate the way the whole industry has changed and the whole climate around media has changed.
No, I think it's really useful, and to me it's a really interesting insight, because the world of, like, we're all obviously invested. The three of us are obviously invested as Purdue fans in the success in Purdue on the recruiting trail and things like this. But at least the three of us are able to step back and see these are the lives of 15 to 18 year old kids, basically. What's it like, you know, recruit or reporting on 15 to 18 year olds, are you interacting more with them? Are you interacting more with their circle? And do you see the different variations of polished, like media polish, that some of these kids have?
Yeah, well, you know, you tend to get things taken away from you over the course of time. I used to have, you know, some rules that I adhered to in recruiting where I would not talk to a 15-year-old ever under any circumstances would I interview a high school freshman or anybody younger than that, just for my own personal preference. And there was one year at a tournament where I went up to the AU coach to say, hey, can I talk to you about this kid for a few minutes? And I turn around and like five other reporters were already interviewing that player. And you just kind of have to do whatever the marketplace dictates you have to do to be competitive. So that went by the wayside really quickly. The one thing kind of in general I think I wish people kept in mind more was that these are all human beings. These recruits are kids. A lot of them are children, perhaps not by age, perhaps not by physical appearance, but they are in their highly influential formative years. And when they read on Twitter about how awesome they are, how much they suck, or when they go to the school you on Twitter don't think they should go to, when you post something about wishing they'd tear their ACLs or something like that, that stuff impacts them. And that these are very impressionable kids, and that stuff can be detrimental to both sides. The positive stuff can be detrimental because it can warp the way they kind of view themselves. Like I always say, don't feed the bears at the national park, because it makes them keep coming back for more. And I don't know if that makes any sense or not. When you tell a kid at 15 years old how awesome he is, that's not good for a 15-year-old. When you tell a kid at 15 years old or 17 years old how bad he is because he didn't commit to your school, that's not good for him either. When you take a college freshman or sophomore and you repeatedly tweet at him about how bad he sucks because he, you know, threw too many interceptions at a football game, you got to understand these are human beings with families, and these are real people, and the stuff is just awful in a lot of cases. But, yeah, I mean, that's kind of one thing you always have to keep in mind, especially in recruiting, because these kids are in such a, you know, fragile stage of their lives where they can go one way or the other. And there's enough people pulling at them that they don't need, you know, people on social media. Recruit has ever committed to a school because of a school's fans tweeting him more than other people. Mace's decision based off of that, then you don't want that kid anyway because he's an idiot. And I just called a teenager an idiot after I just said
teenagers in general. So that's somehow worse or better? No. Do you get the sense that do some pay more attention to social media than others? There's been one football recruit in particular who ended up not coming to Purdue comes to mind as someone who paid a lot of attention to what was going on social media. Or do a lot of these kids, do they have to adapt and learn to block some of that stuff out?
Well, it's their world. Social media is their world now. I don't even know what I'd compare it to for my generation, but this is, every kid nowadays has a national audience, a national platform. And to be honest with you, if I were 15 or 16 years old again, I'd have no idea how I'd handle that sort of thing. Absolutely. I would probably post 20 times. Hell, I'm 38 years old. I can't stay off Twitter. I tweet all the time. And I tweet about half as many times as I probably could. I don't know what I would do when I was 17. I don't blame these kids at all for being that active on it. This is how they interact with their friends. This is how they keep up with the real world. This is how they get their news. This is their world. And we're all kind of peeking into it. And when people step across that line and start, you know, trying to force themselves into that world, very often, bad things can probably happen.
In addition to the huge impact that social media has had, what other sort of changes, particularly with recruiting, have you seen? One thing that sort of strikes me as, at least in football, it seems like you have recruits who will commit early and then look to move up to like the next level. You know, might take a MAC offer and then entertain offers from like Purdue. Might take a Purdue offer and then entertain offers from Ohio State. Has that changed, or are we just more aware of that because of the increased media presence?
Well, I think more guys are probably committing early because of the scrutiny on them right away. I'm guessing that's the fact. I think more kids are probably committing early, too, and I'm talking more about football than basketball here because football and basketball recruiting are still very, very different. I think in football, a lot of guys now are savvy enough to understand that they can work the system. They can accept their first scholarship offer and then just see what happens. That way, if nothing else happens, they've got their place reserved. The one thing media attention on recruiting has done is it has empowered the recruit. Forever, football recruiting was all about the coaches had all the power. They had all the leverage because they controlled information. Now, a college coach who 20 years ago might have told a kid he was the only running back they were going to sign that year, only to have that kid show up a couple months later with three other running backs, that coach can't do that anymore. What media attention has done, it has taken away or severely hindered a college coach's ability to lie to recruits. And that's a big deal. That's a really big deal. And it just seems like the stigma, too, of decommitting in football recruiting is gone, completely gone. Whereas a decade ago, a decade and a half ago, that was still a big deal. If you decommitted from somebody, you got branded with that scarlet letter and people questioned your character. Now it's just like, it's just kind of expected. It's just, that's kind of the way it works. The SEC especially, because it's just a complete battle royal down there. Absolute dumpster fire in terms of what's going to happen on signing day, what's going to happen before signing day, what's going to happen throughout the course of the process, and it's kind of filtered out to the rest of the country, and there's so much media attention on it that, you know, sometimes a guy commits early and he doesn't get his day. So if he draws things out and he really values attention, creating some drama to his recruitment is a good way to get that attention. Now, is he making the most important decision of his life to this point based on the right reasons? No, he's not. But he's 17 years old, and like I talked about before, these kids are fragile, they're influential, and these are the decisions 17-year-olds make. And you could not pay me enough money, probably, to be a college recruiter, because the nonsense involved in this is through the roof. And college coaches spend more of their time, valuable time, by the way, which in this era of student-athlete welfare in the NCAA, you still have coaches spending so much of their time on simple busy work, just, you know, in the stupidity of recruiting, tweeting at recruits, writing letters to recruits. I wrote something for our site a couple months ago about how the NCAA should crack down on mail. One letter a week, that's what it should be, because coaches sit there for God knows how much time a week, probably an hour or 2 a week, just writing letters. It's like the opening credits in The Simpsons where Bart's writing something on the board 100 times. That's what college coaches are doing when they could be, you know, checking in on their players, checking in on their players' grades, talking to their players, spending an extra hour a week with their families. It's just, you know, we don't take good enough care of our coaches in the NCAA right now. And I think that gets lost in this because of all the drama associated with recruiting. The drama is fun to follow sometimes. It's maddening to follow sometimes, but the toll it takes on the people having to do it has to be just extraordinary.
What changes would you suggest? So, in terms of decommitments, how do you feel generally about a student athlete decommitting, and then either recommitting to that school or checking out the other offers that are available? And the other thing is, how would you change this? What are some of the simple changes that, since you kind of see the stuff behind the curtain, that you would suggest?
Oh, you just hit one of my hot button issues. Get rid of signing.
Right.
Get rid of signing day entirely. What I would do, and this would take some slight modifications to the system, first of all, the NCAA would have to allow you to officially offer a scholarship pretty much at any time. Right now it's not until, I think, August 1st or September 1st or something of a player's senior year. But I would do away with signing day altogether and let a player who wants to commit somewhere sign right after he commits, provided he's taken an official visit to that school and after a couple of day waiting period. just to allow for some sort of cooling off. What this would do, in my opinion, is it would make the kid put his money where his signature where his mouth is, and it would make the school put their money where their mouth is. Because what happens now is anybody can commit at any time, and anybody can back out of that commitment at any time. On the other side of the coin, college coaches can offer anybody at any time, and they can pull that offer mm-hmm. at any time. Yep. So if a kid wants to decide under a no signing day sort of arrangement, if a kid wants to commit on September 1st, and then he has to petition to some sort of letter of intent board to get a letter of intent that he can sign then and there when he receives it, provided he's taken an official visit to the school he wants to commit to, then the kid is locked into the school. But the school is locked into him, too. So they have to make sure that, you know, his grades are in order. They have to do everything they need to do, and they can't pull that off for any time. What this does is if a kid's not willing to sign his letter of intent right away, then the college coaches know exactly what's going on. I don't think my answer here has been particularly eloquent because I didn't I got caught off guard by the question. But if
gotcha. Original,
I promise you, it was spelled out in extraordinary detail and very funny lines and something I wrote called a recruiting manifesto a couple months ago on our site. I have no idea where it is, but basically the proposal would be to do away with signing day altogether and allow for kind of a floating system where a kid could get a letter of intent after he takes an official visit to a school, sign it right away, and it's all over then.
So I read that, and that's kind of where my question came from. And I thought it was a really great idea, but when you explained it to me just now, I didn't think about it from the coach's point of view. I've only thought about it from the player's point of view, that the coach cannot recruit out from under him, as you see in some of the basketball schools south of West Lafayette. That part was pretty obvious to me, but I didn't kind of think about the way that it would affect the coaches. So I thought you did a good job. I'd do a 9 out of 10. Not bad.
What would I have to do to get that last point?
Just compliment Anish. He's a complete pushover with a couple nice words. So that would get rid of, like, what happened with the Derek Willis situation, right? Like, a high coming off of a good visit, sort of like you said, the cooling off period.
Yeah, I was actually more talking about football, just because of the way football has gone mm-hmm. with the numbers and just kind of the chaos involved in football. Basketball's still a little bit different. I know Purdue's been involved in a bunch of weird decommitment situations, for better and worse, but that's still not the norm in basketball. And I think in basketball it's so accelerated that I don't think you could in good conscience have a kid sign a letter of intent as a 15-year-old or a 16-year-old. I just don't think it would be viable for basketball like it would be in football. Because football, 90% of the recruiting nowadays is still done during the player's senior year when he's mm-hmm. really got to hone down on making a decision and the majority of the pressure is coming at him. Whereas in the case of a Derek Willis, for example, he still had 3 years ahead of him. It just so happened that when Purdue was able to get him, everybody in the world found out about him, and he happens to live in a state that is very, very, shall we say, aggressive in recruiting and passionate about basketball. And as soon as his name got out there, I could have told you exactly what was going to happen, and it did. And Purdue told him what was going to happen. They said, all right, look, you're committing to us. Here's what's going to happen. Everybody else is going to realize how good you are, and here are the schools who are going to come after you. Now, what are you going to do? And that's exactly what happened, and what he said he was going to do changed. Yeah. And that tends to happen sometimes when you're mm-hmm. dealing with teenagers and their families.
The last one ended up okay.
I mean, it's not like anybody should give second thought anymore to Derek Willis.
No, but it was just a fascinating like recruiting instance. The other thing was the last recruit that I remember committing early, like as early as some of those, like as a 15-year-old, was Ray Davis, and that's worked out to this. And all the recruits after Ray Davis, I don't think were committed or were even in serious talks until very late, until their second half of their junior year or first half of their senior year.
Yeah, that's the way it used to be.
Yeah. So I mean, so has that been within just the last 4 years that it's changed?
I don't think so. I think, you know, you go back to the old stories about Bob Knight offering Steve Alford as an eighth grader. And I think, in, especially in a state like Indiana, guys get noticed so early because this state is so unbelievably basketball-centric that it's hard to be a really good player really young and not get noticed. And when you get noticed by college coaches, too. All of a sudden, they, you know, they start to recruit you. What's changed has been the really early scholarship offers. And what I mean by really early is I mean, like, as freshmen, even before that. And the scholarship offers aren't, you know, they aren't finite. There's too many offers being thrown out to freshmen and sophomores that colleges can just walk away from basically at any time. You've seen Indiana do that with a lot of guys that they've offered right away and then not even followed up on hardly at all. You've seen Purdue even do that. But the thing with offering 15-year-olds is that you have no idea what they are going to be. Mm-hmm. You know, you can look at them as 15-year-olds and say, hey, this kid's big, fast, whatever else. He's a good player. Here's what he can do from a skill set perspective. But you have no idea what he's going to be 4 years later. The kids get better. They are not static beings. They get better and they get worse. And sometimes a kid as a 15-year-old is physically developed or he's unbelievably advanced as a basketball player, and then he doesn't get better. And then everybody in his class passes him up because they're still young and they still have upside and they accelerate beyond a player who's already where he should be as a high school junior or senior, as an eighth grader or a high school freshman. So that's what makes it such a dangerous game for, you know, for basketball recruiters. Because you offer a kid as a sophomore, he commits, you're stuck with him. In most cases, I mean, there are ways out, but you don't want to exercise those ways out because you burn bridges with people. It's not the right way to treat people. But coaches play this unbelievably dangerous game when they're recruiting these guys so early. But it's like anything else, is if let's say Purdue doesn't do it, somebody else is gonna. And stay in the game to be able to get guys, you have to adhere to the conditions on the ground. And right now in basketball recruiting, the conditions on the ground are to recruit guys this early. And it's not healthy for anybody. It's not healthy for the kids. It's not healthy for the college coaches. It's not healthy for anybody. But that's kind of the way things have gone. Things get crazier and crazier every year.
So kind of like the intersection of, like, just real quick, because I have to bring his name up because we're doing a podcast right now. An interesting thing happened that I don't think too many people noticed was that Vince Edwards almost tried to commit as, like, early sophomore. And I do remember that that it was directed at Micah Shrewsbury. He was like, Coach Shrew, I got some good news for you. And then either that tweet deleted right away or nothing happened after that. Did the coaches talk him out of it, or can you talk about that? I don't know.
No, the coaches would have taken his commitment in a heartbeat.
Yeah.
I think what happened was cooler heads kind of prevailed, and I think kids are emotional, you know, just like the rest of us. You get wrapped up in a great visit, you get wrapped up in a great phone call with a college coach, and you just want to commit. But, you know, you don't always look at the big picture. You don't always understand that you have to make decisions based on substance, and you have lots of time to develop that substance. You don't want to make a rash decision because it's the most, you know, it's the most important decision you have made in your life to that point. And I, you know, to talk about the specific instance we're discussing here, Vince Edwards comes from a very basketball-savvy family. His father was a great player at Wright State. His mom played college basketball. His two older brothers played college basketball, and I think probably there was just some sentiment that's like, hey, we hold the cards here. You're in a great situation. Let's just kind of let things play out a little bit. Let's make sure this is what you want to do. And as it turned out over time, Purdue remained what he wanted to do, and you know, some other people came at him, but he was pretty sold on Purdue. That didn't change over the course of time, and he ultimately made the same decision he wanted to make as a high school sophomore.
Before a program like Purdue, it doesn't seem like Purdue can wait. It's a weird balance, because if Purdue waits until a kid's senior year, the summer for the senior year, it might be too late to get in. But if you offer early and it doesn't pan out, then you're in a rough spot. So for Purdue to be successful, is it simply a matter of hitting more often than you're busting on some of these early offers? Or how do you, as a coach of a program at Purdue's level, sort of manage that balance?
Well, the longer you recruit a kid, the better you know him. The longer you recruit a kid, the better relationship you have with him. So when you recruit guys really early and they commit right away, you can't be dead certain what you're getting. And I think Purdue got burned on that a little bit there for a while when it just so happened those two back-to-back classes, everybody just committed right away. It was the weirdest thing I've ever seen in my life. Fans got to the point where they expected, because of those two classes, 2012 and 2013, where if a kid was offered as a sophomore and he didn't commit, fans on our message board would convince that kid was never coming to Purdue. That's just not reality. It just so happened those two classes were so weird. But I think, you know, Purdue missed on some guys because they filled up so early. I think they kind of recommitted themselves after that to kind of playing things out a little more. Matt Painter said that he hasn't been so solely focused on recruiting Indiana first and foremost as he was before, and he has gotten some guys that he recruited later in the process these last couple of classes. It's working out pretty well for him. Mm-hmm. You know, Purdue's got a great core in place right now of guys who were recruited, you know, they weren't the guys who committed as freshmen, who were offered as eighth graders, or who committed as sophomores when they were offered as freshmen. There are good players Purdue got in those situations that are still on this team, but when you look at their core right now, they're all guys who kind of were picked up relatively late in the process relative to some of the guys who came before them.
So given that state, I think that's a really interesting point about Matt Painter focusing outside of the state of Indiana, because traditionally, maybe 2013 accepted, there is a ton of prep talent in Indiana, but it seems like IU and Purdue both have sort of looked outside its borders for its players. Is that just a blip, or do you think that's part of a larger trend to, now that recruiting is a program like Purdue can recruit over a wider geographic area?
Yeah. Make no mistake about it, Purdue's still going to recruit Indiana first and foremost. They're always going to be on top of the best players in the state at an early age. They're just not going to, you know, put their sole focus or the majority of their focus on Indiana. You've seen what they've done in Ohio. You've seen what they've done in Texas. They've recruited all over the place. And I think maybe in years past, they would have just offered the 10 best players in Indiana, seen who they could get, and then kind of adjusted accordingly. Now, based on what Matt Painter's both said and done, it looks like, you know, he might offer five guys really in Indiana and five guys in Ohio or five guys from here or there or wherever else instead of just being so focused on Indiana. So it's not like Indiana's not a focus anymore. It's just not their sole focus.
There's a common theme that you hear sometimes from Purdue fans that the cards are sort of stacked against Purdue in Indiana. Do you feel like there's any sort of truth to that? It does seem like Notre Dame football and IU basketball are sort of the behemoths in the state, but do you think it's really as bad as some people make it out to be?
Well, that's always going to be a challenge at Purdue. You know, there's all sorts of reasons why, but this is obviously a state with a pretty intense Indiana following in basketball, and I suppose a pretty intense Notre Dame following in football, even though Notre Dame's more of a national brand than it is a local brand. But that's just kind of the nature of the two schools, their stories and their kind of infrastructures. You know, Indiana has a lot of alums in Indiana and a lot of Subway alums, and that's the product of a lot of years of winning, a lot of things that Purdue would have to do a lot of winning for a lot of years to overcome. And there's still this state's still crawling with IU fans, and I don't think that's ever going to change. And that's something to overcome in recruiting, because when you have a kid who is considering Purdue and Indiana, chances are when you play the Kevin Bacon game, you're not going to have to go much farther. You're going to have to go a lot farther to find a Purdue influence than you are an Indiana influence. That's almost always the case. That's not always the case, but it's very, very common that there's going to be an IU person or an IU influence closer to a kid, whether it's an AU coach, a high school coach, just a fan, a parent, whoever else. That stuff does matter. That stuff really does matter. When you look at, you know, the passion of the fan bases. Purdue's got a great fan base in basketball. Unbelievable, lively, energetic, knowledgeable fan base. Indiana's got the same thing, only times 10 in terms of numbers. And that stuff matters to recruits because they go on campus visits, they get shown around campus like they're God himself, and that stuff matters. But the other part of it too is, you know, you start building a culture in a program. I know fans sometimes hate the word culture, but it really matters. You start building a culture before kids are even on campus, and when kids get treated like rock stars, you know, when they're on their visits, it sets a certain expectation that's not easily shaken when they get to campuses. And you know, Purdue is kind of a no-frills place and embraces that, as it should. And when a kid comes on a visit to Purdue, things are kind of laid out for them that you're going to class, you're giving effort, you know, whatever else. Not to say other places don't talk about that stuff too, but it's all you get at Purdue, you know, for the most part. That, and obviously, practical basketball talk and a fun weekend, but it's not the rock star treatment you will get, a recruit will get somewhere else. And that stuff can be damaging. We talked a lot before about the influence on 15, 16, 17-year-olds of social media and being told how awesome they are or how bad they are. Well, if you go somewhere for 48 hours and it's nothing but partying, it's nothing but, you know, being told how awesome you are, being recognized by old men on the street because everybody knows who your school's recruiting and they live for this stuff, you know, sometimes that can work against the program who's recruiting these kids. And, you know, I think there's some very specific examples, I'm not naming names here, where the culture is a little bit eroded because of that rock star kind of culture.
So moving real quick to the current program as it exists, it seems like within the Purdue fan base, there is a lot of energy, and you touched on this a little bit earlier about really energetic Purdue basketball fans, and I think Purdue fans, perhaps spurred by some of the struggles that the football team is experiencing, but just in general, are really excited for basketball season to start, really think there's a high ceiling for this team. Yep. From a national media standpoint, they're not really getting the same sort of attention. Is the national media underestimating Purdue, or are Purdue fans sort of overestimating where this team could land? Like, what's the floor and ceiling of Purdue basketball?
I think that, you know, somewhere in the middle, the truth lies, whether it's whether or not Purdue's being overlooked or overrated by their own fans locally. I think, you know, Purdue's got a lot of questions to answer. They got to make a jump shot. That's everybody can talk about point guards all they want. Everybody can talk about lineup changes, whether Vince Edwards is playing the three, how that works defensively, how Caleb Swanigan is going to do it before, if that's where he plays. But the most important thing to me is Purdue's got to make a jump shot. They've got to make jump shots and they've got to make free throws. Because when you look at those things, what that meant to them last year. If you make a three-pointer here, hell, if you made one more three-pointer against Cincinnati, you make the second round and you lose to Kentucky. But the craziest thing about last season for Purdue was just that it overcorrected, quite honestly, from a personnel standpoint, in three-point shooting. It brought in these guys who can really shoot, and I promise you they can really shoot because I've seen it myself in high school, in practices, wherever else. You can say whatever you want about, well, that's not games. That's true, it's not games. And they shot the exact same percentage they did the year before without the same caliber of shooters. And the way Purdue's playing in terms of its emphasis on the post, the value of being able to make jump shots cannot be overstated because of the room, you know, you need to operate down low with Hammonds, Haas, and now Caleb Swanigan. So the most important thing to me is their ability to make jump shots. And, you know, they generated better shots for better shooters last year, and they didn't improve at all. And that was absolutely bizarre. So that it starts right there. You know, obviously the point guard position, John Octis is going to be very difficult to replace. John Octis was a good player. But John Octis was a great player in context for Purdue last year because of what they didn't have going into the season. Hell, what they didn't have 2 weeks before the season. So I think P.J. Thompson will be much improved. I think Johnny Hill will be solid. So, but there are a lot of questions, and that's where you can look at Purdue like, well, maybe they shouldn't be in the top 25. But then the reasons maybe they should be in the top 25 are, you know, are that there's a lot of them. You know, there's not a school in the country that can match their both their size and their ability down low. Those aren't just three really big guys. Those are three really good big guys. And 75% of the teams in college basketball don't have one really big, good big guy. They would kill for one of these guys. Purdue's got three of them. And I think Vince Edwards is going to be a really good player. I think people realize that now. I think people who paid attention last year know he's going to be pretty good. I think people realize, too, Kendall Stevens and Dakota Mathias kind of as a tandem at that two-guard slash three position have a chance to be really good. So people know what Purdue has. It's just a matter of, you know, they have some questions to answer. So I think fans probably are focusing on the good things, which is what they do by nature in most cases. National media are focusing on the questions, which sometimes is what national media tend to do by nature. So as I said before, I think, you know, whether they're overrated or by fans or underrated by media, I think kind of somewhere in the middle of the truth lies.
Do you think any of the shooters, or so, you know, you're talking about Ryan Klein that they're bringing in. He's tremendous. Also, Grant Weatherford is, you know, this Chris Kramer-esque comparison has come up. Do you think either of them redshirt, or do you think, as Bowler Dowd liked to question, Isaac Haas takes a redshirt just to get stronger, just to get a little bit stronger?
Yeah. You can stand to put on a couple pounds. I'd be surprised if one of those guys didn't redshirt because of your numbers. It's like, well, where are they going to play? Just when you look at them on paper, you have to see an opportunity for those guys to play. And I know I just said that, you know, the most important thing for Purdue this season is to make jump shots, and Ryan Klein is a diabolical jump shooter. But you have to assume Kendall Stevens and Dakota Mathias are going to be better because they're better shooters than they showed last year. You know, universe theoretically has to balance itself out. I just don't see where you find minutes for both of those guys. To be honest with you, I would be surprised if, and we've written a lot about this at goldenblack.com, I'd be surprised if Ryan Klein didn't redshirt because, you know, Matt Painter talks all the time, I call it the Ryan Smith principle, where he wasted, by his own admission, he wasted Ryan Smith for a year, and then by the time Ryan Smith was a senior, he was a good player you could win with. And they should have had him for 4 years. Instead, he played very sparingly as a freshman, and that cut his career short on the back end. And I don't think Matt Painter ever wants to make that kind of mistake again. So I think situations where it's a 50-50 deal, you always have to play the guys who can help you win now. You have to have all hands on deck if you think you can win with the team you have. But if there's a guy who's a little bit superfluous, you can't get him into the rotation, or you don't think the payout is going to be as much as it needs to be to justify using him, I think Matt Painter is going to err on the side of redshirting guys, and I think Ryan Klein is the rare instance of a guy who, you know, probably can be held out this year without you missing much of a beat, because you essentially have two starters at his position right now, but also somebody who's going to be down with the idea, who's going to be receptive from the very start of the conversation, because in recruiting, he and his family talked about understanding the value of redshirting if that's what Purdue wanted to do with him. So I think that's not even going to be a very difficult conversation for Purdue to have if they come to the point where they want to have that conversation. So it's a very unique circumstance. Sometimes with players, you have to explain to them why. You have to sell them on redshirting. You have to convince them. And you have to make them understand that by wanting to redshirt you, we're not telling you you're not good enough. We're telling you that we think as a fifth-year senior, you're going to be way better than you will be as a true freshman. And I don't think you have to worry about that with Ryan Klein. I think he's naturally wired to understand that stuff.
Johnny Hill. I have only seen YouTube highlights of Johnny Hill. What does he give this Purdue team? Noctius gave shooting, athleticism. He was also a very underrated rebounder. He was that jack of all trades that Purdue needed last year. Johnny Hill, can he step into that same sort of role, or is he going to be a different kind of point guard for Purdue?
Yeah, well, just the word I keep hearing is just solid, reliable, that I think he's going to be somebody. When you look at Purdue, what do they need from their point guards?
Move the ball.
defend and don't screw up. Don't turn the ball over. If Purdue can get guys who just defend the position the way Purdue needs it defended and get Purdue into its offense, get the ball where it needs to be, and it's pretty obvious where it needs to be, and don't turn the ball over, don't make mistakes, Purdue's going to be fine because they have one of those true situations where the point guard is there to just get the ball to other people, to get their personnel in the best positions to win basketball games. And Purdue's got personnel around their point guards good enough to win basketball games. And it's just going to be the point guard's job to just be solid. I know that sounds like I'm channeling Matt Painter because that's what he says all the time, but it's absolutely true. Is you're not running a point guard-centric offense here. You're not running this isn't a point guard program right now. This is a big man program, and the point guard's just part of it. And I think between P.J. Thompson and Johnny Hill, you just need those guys to kind of do their jobs, to use another horrible coach's cliche that drives us nuts.
You're becoming one of them.
I am. 15 years of listening to this stuff.
I think I'll wrap up with a lighthearted question. What's your favorite running joke on Knucklehead Central? I'm going to go with the neck tattoo. Do you have a personal favorite?
Yeah, I shouldn't have done the neck tattoo thing. That's something I really regret, because what that did was that made me the story. And that took some attention off, you know, Trayvon Blewett and what was actually going on in that recruitment. I really shouldn't have done that. But that has gotten pretty funny. I don't know where the $10,000 a week thing came from.
I think that was a typo.
I kind of feel bad because we have an unbelievable staff. Kyle and Stacy here in the office do an unbelievable job. And I think sometimes they believe it. I think they think I really make $10,000 a week. And
really, well, our listeners can't see you, but we can see your video. And maybe it's because you're just dressing too flashy. I think you're showing off too much of your wealth that if you toned it down, maybe they wouldn't think that.
Yeah, the gold chain, it's a little much.
The gold teeth and the diamond encrusted glasses are really too much, Brian.
Pretty big time, huh?
We are interviewing Lil Jon from 2005, if you didn't know.
Well, thank you very much for coming on and talking to us. Got a lot of great insight into what you do and how you sort of go about your business. And for anyone listening who is not a subscriber, I don't know why you aren't. I don't know why you're listening to this and not subscribe.
I don't know where that Venn diagram is, but
but thank you very much for coming on board. Really,
no problem, guys. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.